We'll begin, and as we have only three members present, we will begin as a work session. When the other members join us, we will go to full committee, and no listing legislators. It's now 9:30 on the 27th of January. Senator Hoffman is online, and the purpose of today's meeting is to talk with revenue on the roles of ASPIB and the Treasury, and for the Department of Administration again on the TIER redesign project report. We'll sort of continue the discussion from yesterday. Senator Wilkins, do you have any comments or any?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Reminder on for cell phones and pagers, all need to be turned off. Teleconference sites online are Anchorage and Fairbanks. I have no idea if anyone else has called in, but this is a listen only, except for Mr. Reynolds, who will be testifying on behalf and assisting the Department of Administration. If you will, because of our timeline, we will hold all questions till the end of the day and write your question down, make your reference, because we have to get through the presentation. If we need a third meeting, we are scheduled in this room for tomorrow morning, and we can come back at that time. Otherwise, we hope to get through the discussions, allow ample time for a clear explanation, and then at the end of the day, we'll examine questions or comments from any of the members, and we'll continue at another meeting if need be. We've been joined in the finance room by Senator Olson, so we are therefore fully endowed meeting and ready to go into business. Okay, first is Departments of Revenue. I assume all three of you have come to the table, please. Join us. Welcome. Commissioner, if you could introduce your friends there, yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, and for the record, I'm Bill Corbis, Commissioner of Revenue. With me on my right is Deputy Commissioner Treasury, Tom Butan, and on my left, Gary Bader, who is the Chief Investment Officer for the Alaska State Pension Investment Board, as well as the Treasury Division. Also with us is Jerry Burnett, who is the Legislative Liaison for the Department of Revenue. It's my understanding that Madam Chair, we have 30 minutes, and we're going to address four issues. First of all, we're going to give a brief overview and structure of the Treasury Division within the Department of Revenues. I'm going to do that next. Tom Butan is going to review with you the Treasury and investment funds that we play a role in managing and investing. We're going to talk about the relationship of ASPIB investment policy to the PERS, TERS, actuarial assumptions. Gary Bader will cover that. And finally, Gary Bader will lead us through the ASPIB investment process. And if we have time, we're available for questions. As an overview of the structure of the Treasury Division, our mission and measures of state results, our job is to collect and invest the state's money. The Commissioner of Revenue has fiduciary responsibility for approximately $4 billion of the state's funds. Tom Butan will review what those funds are with you. He also sits as a member of the Alaska State Investment Board and has equal responsibilities with the other seven members of that board. Treasury Division has a number of functions collection of the money, cash management, as well as making sure that we follow all the guidelines and so forth that we've established for ourselves. But perhaps our most difficult and challenging job is to invest the money. And we have a 13-person investment staff that carries out that functions. Most of those individuals are either chartered financial analysts or are in the process of obtaining their CFA. This division is led by Gary Bader, and he is assisted by Bob Mitchell, who is in charge of the fixed income portfolio. The Treasury staff, the Treasury investment, the 13 people we have just listed or informed you of, provides the staff for the Alaska State Pension Investment Board, as well as for the $4 billion odd dollars of money that we manage for the state as a common staff for both responsibilities. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Tom Butane to brief us on the investment funds that we watch over for you and invest for you.
Thanks.
Before you begin, Tom, I'd like to recognize that Senator Gary Stevens has joined us, and Senator Con Bundy, and Senator Fred Dyson. Thank you.
Thanks. The Treasury Division managed and invested state money amounting to just under $20.5 billion as of last December 31st. This handout, and I apologize for the small print, I guess figure the amount, maybe the smaller the print, breaks that out by fiduciary and within those headings by beneficiary group or agency. Monthly invested asset information can be found on the Treasury website every month. On behalf of ASBIB, Treasury manages four defined benefit programs and two participant-directed plans. Treasury manages money for four state agencies. However, some of those agencies require the money to be segregated in a more than one fund. Treasury also manages 27 other funds for which the Commissioner of Revenue is fiduciary. Cash flows, cash needs, liquidity, and investment restrictions, such as Internal Revenue Code restrictions on proceeds from tax-exempt bonds, vary by fund. As anyone would predict, expected and actual financial results are impacted by those requirements and restrictions to varying degrees. So far as details, the procedures we'll talk about today are limited to Treasury and ASBIB. In the 1992 legislation that established ASBIB as it now stands, Treasury received the direction that in exercising the investment custodial and depository powers or duties, the fiduciary of a state fund shall apply the prudent investor rule and exercise the fiduciary duty in the sole financial best interest of the fund. Treasury further refines the prudent investor rule to the standards of 1, an institutional investor, 2, a professional, and 3, an investor managing large investments. While some funds managed by Treasury and entrusted to the Commissioner of Revenue are trust funds, such as the Public School Trust Fund and the Children's Trust, Treasury uses the same investment process and standards for all funds. So far as procedures, Treasury prepares written investment policies and documents investment processes. Each fund has missions and objectives which lead to an appropriate asset allocation strategy and establishment of specific investment policies. Investment managers are selected for each fund to implement the investment policy. And I should, as an aside, of course, we do about $4 billion of fixed income management internally, and then the balance of the funds are with external managers. Performance and activities of managers is strictly monitored, evaluated, and documented. ASBIB and then separately the Commissioner of Revenue hold formal quarterly meetings to monitor performance and asset allocation. Minutes are kept in those meetings, etc. Any monthly, quarterly, annual results are reported. Annual results are audited by independent auditors. AS 37.10.071 allows Treasury to set up investment pools. We establish benchmarks, and we have a written policy blue book. Policies can be found on our website. We have a very formal processes for asset allocation and asset classes, expected return, risk, time and time horizon, risk tolerance, liquidity, and evaluation, hiring and firing of money managers. So far as results, I think the main focus of this committee today and at this time is PERS and PERS. The fiscal year 04 rate of return for PERS was 15.08% and for TERS was 15.09%, including the exceeding the median return for public funds as reported by Cowan Associates, and of course exceeding also the actuarial assumption that you're familiar with. I have a handout, you have it, that shows a graph showing the rate of return experience since 1991 and comparing that to the rate of return used by the actuarial consultant. A second graph on that page shows where we sit with respect to the risk versus return compared with a larger universe of comparable funds. Now I'll turn it over to Gary Bader, our Chief Investment Officer, who will give details about investment policies.
Thank you, Mr. Boutin. First of all, we'd like to address the question of who sets the actuarial rate of return. Statutes provide that in the case of PERS, that the PERS board sets the actuarial rate of return after receiving advice from the Division of Retirement Benefits and the actuary. Each year, the PERS board meets, and the same is true of the TERS board, but the boards meet and they consider the actuarial assumptions put to them by the Department of Administration and the actuary. Once they decide upon the assumptions, the actuary applies those assumptions and comes up with the estimated contribution rates required of the employers in the system. That information is provided to the ASPIB, and the ASPIB is well aware that the PERS and TERS are currently anticipating an 8.25% rate of return over a long period of time. The actuary's investment horizon is more like 25 to 30 years. Each year, the boards meet jointly and receive an actuarial presentation, and ASPIB sets its target earnings for the coming year. So that is how the earnings assumption is set by ASPIB, but really what leads up to that? How do you decide to deploy the assets? You have before you today a packet starting on page one, which has just a Senate presentation, which is an abbreviated version of what the board considers as it goes about setting its asset allocation. It seems to me the best way to give you a feel for what goes on and how we end up where we do is to take you through the process very quickly. Most of these pages are intended only to be exemplars of the types of things that are considered, and I won't dwell on them because of the limitation of time. But starting with page two of the handout, it's an outline that our consultant, the board's consultant, Cowan Associates, starts with in their presentation to the board on capital market assumptions. And by capital market assumptions, I mean, what are they predicting that stocks are going to yield over the next 5 years? What is fixed income going to do? What are the other asset classes going to do? Page four of the handout is the first of several slides intended to demonstrate the types of evaluation Cowan considers when developing their assumptions. They have all the experts of their firm, they convene, and they work on this jointly. This isn't just one person's idea of what will happen. Page five shows their guiding assumptions. Their best thinking for a five-year outlook. Results that are highly defensible, both on their individual asset classes and for total portfolios. They're conscious of the level of change suggested in strategic allocations and benefits and defined contribution plans. And they reflect common sense and recent market developments. The next page, page six, is just a reflection that they asked the board to do on what the asset classes have returned in prior years. And there's a few things I would like to point out about the returns of the different asset classes on page six. First of all, notice the year 2000. And focusing on the top line, Russell 3000, and that's a good proxy for how stock markets did in general. In the year 2000, a 7.46% loss for stocks in general. If I could bring you down the page and look at the Lehman Brothers aggregate, which is a positive 11.63%. This demonstrates one of the basic tenets of investment management is you're trying to have a number of asset classes that have rates of returns that are not necessarily correlated with one another. You can't find that, but to the extent that you can, you want to make your asset allocation according to those principles. The next page, page seven, contains some global perspectives considered by Cowen. Page eight considers some information on the U.S. economy. And I'd like to draw your attention to the fifth bullet point down on page eight. And that is that interest rates are still extraordinarily low. And so what that is basically, they're factoring that into their thinking about how committed we should be to fixed income in the coming time period. Page nine talks about expectations. And I'd like to focus you on the fourth bullet point down. Cowen's outlook in a nutshell, expect low inflation, low interest rates, and a single-digit return environment. Page 10 shows the historical relationship between earnings to price and the S&P 500 returns. So this gives you a perspective on where the stock market is relative to the world. Page 11 shows the historical relationship between earnings yield and the treasury bond. So how do stocks and bonds compare in terms of their relative valuations? Page 12 shows one indicator that might influence opinion on the future returns of bonds. And you can see that there's relatively close tracking between the return on bonds 5 years out and what the yield to worst is today. Page 13 is a thumbnail explanation of the rationale for capital market assumptions, which are presented on page 14. Page 14 shows the capital market assumptions that Cowen presented to the ASPIB, the 2004 capital market projections. And so they are projecting the rate of return, projected annual rate of return, the column headed projected standard deviation is a measure of how likely that return is to be met, or not so much how it is to be met, but how much it's likely to vary from the prediction. Page 15 is a correlation coefficient page. Remember I said that one of the things that we're trying to do in setting the investment policy is to have different asset classes, study their variation, and then determine how they move in relation to one another. If something moves in lockstep with an asset class, it would have a correlation of one. If it moves in exactly the opposite direction, that is, if stocks go up and bonds go down, exactly in the same proportions to one another, it would have a correlation of minus one. And if there is no relationship at all, the correlation would be zero. On page 16 and 17 provides additional information that the board will be considering perhaps its meeting in March, which will be the following, when they actually set the asset allocation. Page 18 is in there to point out to the committee that the ASPIB does not, and the consultant do not work alone in setting this asset allocation. The statutes require that ASPIB has an investment advisory committee. That committee has a minimum of 3 members. The members on that committee are Dr. William Jennings, who has a PhD and a CPA and is a chartered financial analyst and is on the investment or on the finance staff of the Air Force Academy. Also, Dr. Gerald Mitchell, who was an investment manager and ran funds for Wellington Fund and is formerly the chief investment officer of Massachusetts PRIM, the state retirement system for Massachusetts. Also part of that committee is Tim O'Brien, the CPA, and I believe a former trustee of the Colorado Public Employees Retirement System. Is what the Investment Advisory Committee considered when we met, and that was a telephonic conference. We didn't have a meeting on the field, but it was all on the telephone that I met with them. And they proposed to the ASPIB, along with the consultant, that the asset allocation would be what is in the gray column on page 19. And essentially, the gray column said the target rate of return would be 7.84%, and it should have a standard deviation of 11.1% over time. The next page, page 20, is what is known as the efficient frontier, and it simply is a graphic portrayal of what you saw on the previous page. And the basic tenet is that the higher return you expect to get, the more volatility of returns you can expect in trying to achieve that. Volatility is considered a measure of risk. Page 21, you may have noticed the target rate of return was 7.6%. The PERS and TERS are looking for 8.25%. Why the disconnect? Remember that I said that PERS and TERS, the actuary is looking over a 30-year horizon, and that the capital market assumptions provided by Callan were based on 5-year projections. The difference between the two is what is assumed in the inflation adjustment between the two assumptions. Callan had an inflation assumption of 2.6%. The attempt here is to get a 5% real rate of return. If you put in 2.6% inflation, that brings the ASPIP to 7.6%. Mercer also is trying in their assumptions to get a 5% real rate of return. Their inflation assumption over the 30-year period is greater than Callan's is over the 5. And that is why there is a disconnect between the earnings assumption of the PERS and TERS and the target rate of return of the ASPIB. Page 22 and 24 are once again our graphical representations of the probability of return, 22 through 24. Let's just spend a moment on page 22. And I know this was a question put forth by Senator Stedman yesterday. The expected likelihood of getting the target rate of return is right around 50-50, as one would think the market could be higher or lower. Now I would call your attention to the column that says proposed. What is the likelihood of exceeding the target rate of return? For example, what is the likelihood of earning 23.94% in this investment period? And that shows that there's a 10% probability of earning that amount or greater. The reverse follows in terms of losses. If you turn from page 22, or compare page 22 and 24, you would see, although the likelihood of attaining that rate of return is the same, or nearly the same in both pages, the likelihood of differing from that rate of return is diminished. For example, you only have a 10% probability of earning 12.69% over the 3-year period as opposed to the 1-year period. So the longer it's invested, the more likely you are to hit your target or to be close to your target. Page 25 is a graph, and I think this was provided by Mercer. By the way, every exemplar in this packet is a Callan product, except the two that are labeled that have Mercer on it. This is a Mercer exemplar that was provided to the ASPID because the question was asked, how have the rates of return to the funds impacted the funding ratios of the retirement system? And what you see on this page, page 25, is that in a number of periods, the rate of return exceeded what the actuarial rate of return actually turned out to be in those years. So there were a number of years where the ASPIB and the TRS and PERS funds earned higher rates of return than was expected for them. When you aggregate all those returns and you get up to the year 2003, you can see that the impact on the funding ratio of PERS and TERS, in this case it's PERS, but TERS is very similar, that the funding ratio actually, or the investment returns actually only accounted for about 3.8% decline in the funding ratio. If we take into account the investment returns in fiscal year 04, which as Mr. Boutin said, we're in the area of 15.1%, there has been a positive investment return for the funds over the last, since 1993. Page 26 is once again the exemplar that Mr. Boutin referred to in showing the actuarial assumption and the returns of the PERS and TERS funds as provided by Callan. And then page 27 is also an exemplar I think you saw yesterday for the Division of Retirement Benefits, once again affirming that the change in the funded status of the funds, while slightly impacted by investment returns, by and large, it is accounted from other changes in the liabilities of the funds. And that concludes my presentation, Madam Chair.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
I was just going to say it's 10 o'clock. We're ready to move to the back of the room or wherever you direct.
Thank you very much. I'm asking everyone to hold your questions if you can. We have 2 minutes, Senator Stedman.
Oh, that's fine.
Go ahead.
That's fine. No, that's fine. We'll
just write your questions, get them all together, and do it finished. No. Thank you, gentlemen. At least while we change the people. There's some folks online, and if they would like to get information or copies of anything, if they will give us a call or have their LIO contact us, we'll be happy to get the information to them if they don't have it, and we appreciate their listening in. Melanie, good to have you back. Thank you. Good morning. We're holding questions to the end so we can get through these presentations, please. For the record, my name is Melanie Melhorn, and I'm the Director for the Division of Retirement with the Finance Committee members this morning. In the interest of the members' time, I'm going to give a brief overview of the presentation that you're going to receive this morning, and then I'm going to hand the presentation over to Mr. Bob Reynolds. All of the presentation material that you have, with the exception of some very a minor point of the presentation material, has been prepared by Mercer, and this is material that is as of the result of the TIER redesign project. So all of this material has been presented at various different audience groups over a period of time. The TIER redesign project was initiated in January of 2004 by the Commissioner of Administration, and he tasks members of the TERS board and members of the PERS board with coming up with new TIER redesigns that would address two areas. One is the short funded status for the systems, and two, the rising employer contribution rates. So that was the catalyst behind the TIER redesign project. In February of 2004, studies began underway, and during the course of that 9-month period, multiple public meetings were held,
all-day sessions. All of those meetings were advertised. The employers and any interested parties were invited to come and participate with this initiative. And there were employers and other interested parties who did participate during the course of that nine-month period. Those meetings were conducted in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. In November of 2004, the TIER subcommittee had finalized their work on this project and had two alternatives to bring forward to the full board. And that was an all-day meeting that was conducted on November 19th, very important meeting. The results of that meeting, the outcome, were that the four TIER subcommittee members advocated and strongly supported new TIERs, new TIER redesign, specifically alternative one. However, during the course of that meeting, the other PERS and TERS board members did not approve of new TIER redesigns, and as a result, a recommendation was not forwarded to Commissioner Matuszewski. The TIER subcommittee's work is complete. That group is no longer meeting. They have finished all of their work, all of their analysis, all of their conclusions. And there was significant participation by the employers who are the stakeholders of this system at the November 19th meeting, and I think that's important to note. The other part that's important to note is that all of those employers who testified and participated in that all-day meeting, that presentation, which is the culmination of all of that analysis, benchmarking, survey results, advocated for new TIER alternatives. And now I'd like to turn over the presentation to Mr. Bob Reynolds.
Thank you. Mr. Reynolds, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Begin your presentation, please, after you introduce yourself.
Okay, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. For the record, my name is Bob Reynolds, and I am with Mercer Human Resource Consulting. We are the actuaries for the State of Alaska Retirement Systems, the PERS and TERS in particular. The context, however, that I will be describing for you today is work that we performed to serve the TIER committee that Melanie has previously described. And I would say that our role, a summary of our role in that process was facilitating, gathering information, and providing cost analysis of the TIER alternatives that the committee was considering. Is the audio coming through okay on your end?
Yeah, it's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. What I'd like to do here, Melanie has described the process and some of the key information that was gathered. I'd like to spend a little bit more time on that. I would then like to highlight, discuss some of the highlights of the proposed TIER alternatives that the committee arrived at, and discuss some of the long-term cost implications of those alternatives. And you have presentation material in front of you, and I will be referring to, is your material printed two slides per page?
Yes.
Okay, so I will refer to page numbers and slide numbers to help direct your attention to the slide that we're discussing. On page one, slide one, we've talked about that in other settings. That slide just shows the three investment policies that interact in the retirement systems. I don't intend to dwell any further on that one here, but instead would move on to slide two. And the intention of slide two is to set some context and give a little bit of background information that will be helpful later when discussing the financial implications of the new tiers. Slides two and three on pages one and two show similar information. Slide two is related to the PERS system, slide three for the TERS system. What it shows is a little bit of background around our actuarially calculated rates, which are referred to on slide two as average contribution rate, and on slide three as total contribution rates. Those are our calculated rates for the two systems. So for example, for PERS, the average contribution rate that we calculated that would apply to fiscal year 06 is shown on the slide as 25.63%. That average average contribution rate is composed of two components, what we call the normal cost rate and what we call the past service rate. For PERS, we refer to an average past service rate because, as you know, each employer does get their own separate rate calculation relative to their own circumstances. What this chart shows is average contribution rates for the system as a whole. For TERS, it's simply referred to as past service rate since there was only one calculation which does apply to all the employers in the system. So for FY, just to define these terms, on each of the charts there is a definition at the bottom. Normal cost rate is the rate that is intended to provide for benefits that are expected to be earned by the active members during the fiscal year. So that is the cost of the benefits that the members who are actively employed within the systems, it's the cost of the benefits that they are earning during that year. It's the cost of the new benefits. The past service rate is the part of the contribution that is intended to pay off the unfunded liability, and that is intended to be paid off over 25 years. So in any situation where the funding is less than 100% according to our calculations, when there are less assets than there is accrued liability in the system, that deficit is called the unfunded liability, and it is amortized over 25 years, similar to a mortgage, except that it is amortized as a level percentage of payroll. So for FY06, the past service rate for the PERS system was 12.39%. That's the rate that is needed to pay off the unfunded over 25 years. The normal cost rate, the rate of the new benefits, is 13.24 for a total of 25.63%. Based on that information and the regulation that rates can only increase by 5% per year, we also show the board adopted rate, which for FY06 is 16.77%. Similarly, for the teacher system, on slide 3, we show that the normal cost rate for FY06 is 14.28%. That's the cost for the new benefits that the active members will earn, while the past service rate is 24.57% for a total of 38.85%. So you can see that the larger portion of the total contribution rate is actually the part that is required to pay off the unfunded liability. And again, similar to the PERS chart, we show the rates that the board has, in the case of the TERS board, it would be more appropriate to say recommended, and the TERS board has recommended a 21% rate for fiscal year 06. So the one key point perhaps to make from this information is that in the absence of an unfunded liability, if the systems were 100% funded, the calculated rate for the PERS system would be 13.24%, and the calculated rate for the TERS system would be 14.28%. So the rates would be in the 13 to 14% neighborhood were the systems fully funded at this time. Slide 4, we just described further some of the financial context around the TIER study. Clearly, you're aware of these rising contribution levels, volatile investment returns, and some uncertainty as far as investment returns, at least for the near future, as indicated, I think, by the prior presentation, and rising medical costs. On slide 5, we describe some of the key information that was gathered and analyzed by the TIER committee in arriving at the proposed alternatives. There was an extensive body of information that was gathered, discussed, and analyzed over the course of a 10 to 11 month period, and there is a considerable body of information that is available through the division on its website that shows meeting materials from the various meetings that occurred over that time frame. To summarize, there was an employer survey, and I'll come back to that because I think Melanie may want to make some comments. The employers were surveyed. There were focus groups conducted with plan membership. Benchmarking was undertaken to compare the current Alaska programs relative to programs available in other states. One key finding of the benchmarking activity was it was found that the medical program available through the PERS and TERS was considerably richer than other programs offered in similar states. There was numerical analysis of benefit levels available from the systems. Projections were performed of the populations into the future to determine where new members might need to be drawn from in age brackets. As you're aware, there have been recent changes to the Medicare system, and the implications of those changes was considered in this project. Various trends, issues, and alternatives regarding retirement programs around the country were considered, and costs were analyzed and projected. And I'd like to turn it back to Melanie to talk briefly about the employer survey.
Thank you. And as an appendix, we've included the employer survey in the back for PERS and TERS for your review and information in the future. This the survey itself was very, very important because it set the framework to gather information and have employers give the TIER subcommittee input on the benefits that they valued and to determine how they valued those benefits. And we sent out the survey, and then we called the different employers. If we didn't receive the survey, we also walked all the employers through that survey. There were 89 PERS employers who responded. There were 10 who affirmatively indicated that they wished not to participate in that survey. We also sent surveys to all of the collective bargaining unions. There were 11. There was only one union who elected to respond back. Again, we had follow-up calls, and we wanted to walk through with the parties the survey information that we were seeking. And for the teacher's retirement system, there were 36 who responded out of 57 employers. So again, there are stakeholders in the system, and we valued their input in this process. The door was open. Please come engage with us and tell us what you value in a retirement system. I'll turn it back over to Bob.
Thank you, Melanie. On slides 6 and 7, then, we show some of the important conclusions that were drawn from the employer surveys. Slide 6 shows the conclusions for PERS. Slide 7 for TERS. The conclusions were essentially identical, so I will just speak to the PERS slide on slide 6. First of all, employers did feel that the medical program was important and wanted a medical program and coverage to continue. Many employers were open to the possibility of providing different levels of medical coverage depending on length of service or having members share in the cost of coverage. Other potential cost savings areas that employers did appear to be open to included lowering the post-retirement cost of living adjustment or the current PRPAs within the retirement system, and not providing medical coverage to vested terminated members. Vested terminated members are members who leave the system prior to reaching eligibility for retirement, but who are entitled nevertheless to receive a benefit from the system once they reach retirement age. Very few, if any, other systems provide medical coverage to vested terminated members, which we found from the benchmarking activity that we performed. Some of the responses appeared to favor continuing a defined benefit approach, continuing to reward long service, but the responses did in general lean towards shifting some of or all of the investment risk to members. Those were some of the key findings from the employer survey. There were also key findings from the member focus groups as well as the other activities, which taken together led to the committee drafting objectives and constraints for the retirement systems that are articulated on slides 8 and 9. In particular, on slide 8, the objectives were as follows. The system should provide medical benefits to retirees. However, members should bear a greater share of the cost, and members should be required to retire from the system in order to be eligible for those benefits. Benefits should in general favor longer service members. Employer contributions should be more predictable and stable than currently. Investment risk should be shared by employers and members. And the healthcare inflation risk should be shared by employers and members. The last two points perhaps are key. Under the current system structure, the investment risk and healthcare inflation risk is borne solely by the employers of the system. On slide 9, a few key constraints are articulated. The non-medical benefits must be sufficient to satisfy minimum requirements for employers who do not participate in Social Security. The benefit changes because of legal interpretation in the state of Alaska must take the form of new tiers. No changes can be made to benefits for the existing members, as you're aware. And the annual cost of benefits should be less overall than the current system's normal cost rates. So slides 8 and 9 give a framework for what the committee was aiming at in arriving at the proposed alternatives that will be described later. The next several slides, slides 10, 11, 12, and 13, describe some trends and alternatives that we have observed regarding retirement programs around the country. And so I just would like to speak to them very briefly. And perhaps one point of this is there was a benchmarking activity that was undertaken as part of this study. One thing that was found, however, was that the field is changing. Just as there was a tier committee appointed in Alaska to study this issue and perhaps recommend changes, around the country there are retirement systems that have either made changes to their programs or are considering changes to their programs. So in comparing the system to other programs, it is a little bit difficult to make comparisons because there is a process of change occurring around the country. On slide 10, a few observations about defined benefit programs, which is the defined benefit, the non-medical portion of the PERS and the TERS are defined benefit plans. These plans have experienced higher cost levels and greater cost volatility over the last few years. In particular, their funded status has declined in the last 3 years. There are some advantages to an employer of operating a defined benefit plan. There are retention incentives, which can lead to lower turnover cost. There is some ability to help manage your workforce through these programs, such as retirement incentive programs. And the cost of these programs does tend to be attributed more to longer service employees, so they do tend to reward your longer service employees more than the defined contribution plan might. On slide 11, some further observations. The advantages to the employee of defined benefit plans are the pooling of longevity risk, the fact that the employer in most cases bears the investment risk, so that's an advantage to the employee but a disadvantage to the employer. And these plans do provide predictable, stable retirement income over their retired lives. The challenges to the employer of these plans, of course, are the managing of the investment risk and the cost volatility associated with these programs. Another type of retirement program that you are perhaps familiar with, a 401k plan is an example of this type of plan, is a defined contribution plan. And this is a type of program that is being proposed in terms of the administration's Social Security proposals. A defined contribution plan is an account that is typically invested at the employee's discretion in the marketplace, in mutual funds or stock funds and bond funds. The advantages to the employer of defined contribution plans are that the cost is very predictable. It's typically a level percentage of payroll each year. The cost is stable. The employee assumes the investment risk. There's no long-term administrative commitment because there isn't a payout over a retired lifetime. Typically, the member takes their account with them when they retire. And there is contribution equity among employees. At any age, the employees may all be receiving the same contribution as a percentage of payroll. Advantages to the employee of these kinds of plans are portability, the ability to direct their own investments, and contribution equity among employees. The challenges of these plans are shown on slide 13. It's more difficult to manage a workforce through these plans. Retirement incentive programs are not very practical. Employee-directed money often earns less than professionally managed money. The amount needed at retirement is often underestimated. Typically, employees need to contribute in excess of 10% of their income each year into savings in order to adequately provide for their retirement, but most, for a variety of reasons, do not. And finally, retirees are generally not all that well equipped to transform lump sums accounts into monthly payments that last for the rest of their lives. It's difficult for an individual to manage longevity risk, although it is possible. It's just difficult. Next, then, I would propose moving into some highlights of the proposed alternatives that the committee arrived at. Slide 15 shows a high-level description of the programs themselves. First of all, there were two alternatives that were brought forward to the PERS and TERS boards. Alternative 1 and Alternative 2 described here. The TIER committee recommended Alternative 1 to the boards, but as Melanie described, that was not approved and did not go forward to the commissioner. First, on slide 15, we describe the components of Alternative 1. Alternative 1 has a defined benefit program, a defined contribution program, a medical program, which is different than the current medical program, and a health reimbursement account, or HRA, which is a vehicle similar to a defined contribution account, but with the purpose of setting aside and building a fund to pay for medical expenses in retirement. So there are four pieces to the Alternative 1 proposal. Alternative 2, there were three components. Similar to Alternative 1, there's a defined contribution component, a medical component, and a health reimbursement account. The medical and the health reimbursement accounts in Alternative 2 were identical to those within Alternative 1. The difference between Alternative 1 and Alternative 2 is that in Alternative 2, the defined benefit portion of the retirement program was eliminated, and the costs that would have been directed to the defined benefit program in Alternative 1 were instead directed to the defined contribution part of Alternative 2, so that Alternative 2 has a larger defined contribution component than Alternative 1 does, and no defined benefit portion. Under both proposed alternatives, the member contributions were proposed to be higher than the current tiers, and there's information later in this proposal that describes the member contribution rates under these alternatives. So again, just to emphasize a couple key points at the bottom of slide 15, the contribution rates for the defined contribution component are higher for Alternative 2, and the post-retirement medical program is the same for both alternatives. Slides 16 through 19 give some detail regarding the defined benefit and the defined contribution components of the programs. Without dwelling on them here, I think it is worth your time reviewing them and comparing them to the current program. And in this material, Melanie and the division have put together some detailed charts comparing the current program with the proposed alternatives 1 and 2, and that is found on pages 27, correct me if I'm wrong, Melanie, but I think that information is on pages 27 through 29 of your material?
Correct. That's correct, Mr. Reynolds.
Okay. So the one key point that I would like to make regarding the non-medical portion of the proposed alternatives on the defined benefit and defined contribution alternatives is there are some two graphs in your material on pages 18 and 19 that compare the benefit levels that a hypothetical member might receive from the most recent tier in each of the two systems with each of the proposed alternatives. So for example, on page 9, slide 18, we show a comparison of the value at various ages of the most recent TERS, Tier 2, to alternatives 1 and 2. And what you see from this chart on page 18 is that for members who reach the age 60 and do retire from the system, the current Tier 2 does provide higher benefit levels than either Alternative 1 or Alternative 2. On the other hand, at many ages prior to retirement, you can see that the alternatives proposed, Alternative 1 and 2, in many years actually provide higher benefit levels than the current tier. And on average, what we found is that the benefit levels provided by these proposed alternatives are very similar in value to what's provided from the current Tier 2 for TERS. Similarly, for PERS, a comparison is shown on slide 19. Again, you can see that the most recent PERS tier does provide a slightly higher benefit than proposed Alternative 1 at retirement, but that in many years, in fact most years prior to retirement, the proposed Alternative 1 could provide a higher benefit than the current most recent PERS tier. So what was proposed in terms of the non-medical part of the program was not so much a cost reduction as a risk shifting within the non-medical part of the program. The benefit levels were designed to be roughly similar to what the current system provides, but some of the investment risk was shifted from being solely the employer's to the employee. And the level of shifting is what is different between the proposed alternatives. Alternative 1 shifts some of the risk from employers to members. Alternative 2 shifts all of the investment risk from the employers to the membership. So those are some key, some highlights regarding the non-medical or the retirement part of the proposed alternatives. There are several slides, beginning with slide 20 on page 10 and continuing through slide 28 on page 14 that describe key aspects of the proposed medical program. A couple key points are on page 20. First of all, members must retire directly from the system to be eligible. As I pointed out earlier, terminated vested members who leave before retirement would not be eligible for medical benefits. There would be a system-sponsored health plan that would provide varying levels of subsidy or cost to the members. The medical program was divided up into three phases over a member's retirement. And those phases are from early, if they retire early, prior to normal retirement, that's phase one. phase two would be from a member's normal retirement age to reaching eligibility for Medicare, which currently is age 65. And then a third phase, once the member reaches Medicare eligibility, and the third phase would be similar to the current program, but with a couple key differences, one being the method by which the program coordinates with Medicare, and there would be some cost sharing, a greater degree of cost sharing with the retirement members through premium contributions. So the medical program would be divided up into three phases as described. Early retirees would get access to the program but would need essentially to pay their own way. Upon reaching normal retirement, a member would become eligible for what's called a defined dollar benefit. And what that means is the system would provide money that the member would use to help pay for medical care, but the member would be responsible for the difference between what the system provides and the actual cost of the medical care. And finally, upon reaching Medicare eligibility, there would be a program similar to the current program, but with some key changes as described. The health reimbursement account described earlier is intended to help members set aside money and build up a fund to pay for some of the cost-sharing elements in this proposed program. So with that said, I think it is worth your while spending some time in reading through slides 21 through 28. But unless there's specific questions, in the interest of time and hitting the right, getting the information to you here, I'm proposing to move forward.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Beginning on slide 29 and through slide 38, there is likewise more detailed information on the health reimbursement account aspect of the proposed alternatives. As I described earlier, those are similar to defined contribution plans, which you may are likely familiar with, but they are accounts that are intended to allow members to set aside money towards providing for medical expenses in retirement. These vehicles have been around in some form or fashion for several years, but there has been some legislative activity that has made these is making them more common and more attractive. So there is some more detailed information on the health reimbursement accounts available here because it's a new area for most people. But again, I think for our purposes here, the key point is that it's simply an account that helps accumulate money towards providing healthcare expenses in retirement. Moving on to the financial implications of the proposed alternatives, I would direct your attention first of all to slide 39 on page 20. Slide 39 shows for alternative one what we're calling normal cost rates. And if you refer back to the early part of this presentation, slides 2 and 3, we described what normal cost rates were. The normal cost rate is the cost of the benefits that the members are expected to earn in any given year. So it's the annual cost of the benefits. It doesn't consider any unfunded liability that might need to be paid off. It's a fresh start look at the costs of the retirement system. And what we show on slide 39 are the costs of the various components, the expected costs of the various components of alternative one, for each of the two systems. For example, for the teacher system, for TERS, we show a medical normal cost rate of 3.75%, a defined benefit normal cost rate of 5%, defined contribution rate of 8.5%, an HRA, that's the health reimbursement account, contribution rate of 1.5%, for a total normal cost rate of 18.75%. So it is expected that, on average, the Alternative One program would cost 18.75%. Now, for comparative purposes, the numbers in parentheses show the relevant figures for the current TERS system. The current TERS system has a medical program and a defined benefit program, no defined contribution nor HRA component. The total of the medical and the defined benefit expected costs for the TERS system currently are 22.97% or nearly 23%. So this speaks to one of the objectives of the committee, which was to reduce costs relative to their current level. And you can see in comparing the gross normal cost rate, a cost reduction of a little more than 4%, about 4.25%, from 22.97% to 18.75% in total. Now, of that total cost, the members do bear a share, both within the current system and in the proposed alternative. In the current system, on average for the TERS members, the contribution rate for members is 8.69%. It was proposed by the TIER committee to increase that member contribution rate based in part on feedback from the members to 10%, so that the portion of the cost expected to be borne by the employers, while it's 14.28% under the current program, would be 75% under the proposed program. So the 14.28% relates back to the figure shown on slide 3, the normal cost rate for the employers. It's the part of the contribution that would need to be paid even if the system were 100% funded. And we show a cost reduction then to the employers of the difference between 14.28% and 8.75%, which is roughly 5.5%. The right-hand two columns show similar information for the PERS system. Contribution rates to the medical program of 3.5, defined benefit 4.5, a defined contribution rate of 7, and the health reimbursement contribution of 1%, all of these per year for a total of 16%, 8% of which would be contributed by the member. And that, of course, compares to current rates that on average are 6.81%. The current rates vary depending on classification of member from 6.75 for police officers and firefighters to 7.5 for others members. Or I may have those reversed. So that in total then, under the proposed alternative one, the employer normal cost rate would be 8% compared to 13.24% under the current system. So slide 39 is a detailed expected annual cost comparison of alternative one to the current program. Slide 40 shows similar information for alternative two. Alternative 2 was designed to have an overall cost similar to Alternative 1. As I described before, the medical and the health reimbursement accounts are identical between the two alternatives. The difference is that in Alternative 2, the defined benefit portion was eliminated, and the money that in Alternative 1 had been directed to the defined benefit program was instead added on to the defined contribution rate. So for alternative two, for TERS, there's a medical program with a normal cost rate of 3.75, just as an alternative one. The defined contribution rate is the sum of 5 and 8.5% for 13.5% total. And the health reimbursement contribution rate is 1.5% for, again, a total normal cost rate of 18.75%. A member contribution rate of 10%, and again, an employer normal cost rate of 8.75%. So the programs were designed to have, on the average, similar long-term cost implications both to members and to employers. There are differences between the programs in as far as the level of cost volatility that could be expected to occur from year to year. Alternative one in general has more volatility because it has retained the defined benefit component. Alternative two has considerably less volatility, but there is still some cost volatility inherent in the medical portion of the program. So alternative two is not expected to have no volatility, but is expected to have less volatility than alternative one. I'd be happy to answer questions on those two slides or to turn it over to Melanie to speak to page 21.
Right, Melanie. Page 21 is a historical perspective for PERS and TERS on the normal cost rate as it compares to the actuarially computed rate. So you can take a look at beginning in fiscal year 1983 through fiscal year 2006 to look at what the normal cost rate has been for PERS and TERS. And when you look at the time period from fiscal year 1999 through approximately 2002, that lower normal cost rate incorporates the gains to the system with higher investment returns during that period of time. And then I'll turn it back to Mr. Reynolds. Mr. Reynolds.
Yes, thank you. Slides 22 through 25, pages 22 through 25, are actuarial projections of expectations for what rates might be in the future. And these are for context. These are for the current system, irrespective of a new tier. Pages 22 and 23 show projections for PERS. 22 describes the assumptions behind the projections, and 23 shows the projections themselves. Very briefly, on slide 22, some of the assumptions behind them. First of all, the assumptions are described in detail in our detailed valuation reports that are available from the division and are posted on the division's websites. But to highlight some of the key assumptions, we are assuming that in the future the population will grow at a rate of 1%. We are assuming that the board, the PERS board, will adopt the actuarially calculated rate with the provision, of course, that the rate as required by regulation can't increase by more than 5% per year. And we're looking at three different possible economic futures. One is labeled base case, where we expect that anticipate the fund will earn on average 8.25% per year for the indefinite future. One labeled growth, which is a little more optimistic, with higher returns in the next few years, leveling out to the actuarial assumption in the future. And a pessimistic economic scenario labeled prolonged recession with very poor investment returns for the first few years, rebounding to a higher level, but a level that is still lower than the 8.25% assumption. And just to be clear, for fiscal year 2004, we factored in the known actual return on the funds within the system, which was 15.08%. Page 23 then shows the projections of what we expect rates might be in the future under these scenarios, in particular focusing on the solid line, which is the base case, where returns are 8.25% on average. We expect that the rates will increase 5% per year until they reach a level in excess of 25%, around 27-28%. Then we expect those rates will somewhat level off, but will continue to increase gradually in the future over 25 years, reaching a level as high as 31%, and then decline fairly fast at that point, because recall that the actuarial method is intended to pay off the unfunded over a 25-year period. So by 2029, it's anticipated that if contributions at this level are made, the unfunded liability will be mostly paid off, with the exception of some additions to the unfunded that would occur in the next few years as rates continue to lag the actuarially calculated rate. So and then the other two lines show what the rates might be under different economic scenarios. Focusing on the base case, we expect rates to gradually increase to a level somewhat in excess of 30% over a 25-year period, and then decline.
I think those were in the book yesterday, weren't they?
They were in, yes. So we may be, are we repeating ourselves here?
At a different level, though. TERS was way up like 60%.
These are the same slides.
Yeah, and on page 25, you'll see the TERS level. So perhaps I should summarize more quickly if we've already covered this material. On slide 25, the solid line shows contributions increasing, although as we pointed out before, the TERS board does not have by regulation that constraint. Eventually, we expect contributions to reach a level of 45% and then continue to increase more gradually to a level that is between 50 and 55%, perhaps 53%, and then declining once the unfunded liability has been largely paid off after 25 years. So again, to reiterate the key point, this is our expectations of what rates might be under those scenarios for the current program without a new tier. And that's shown for baseline. Then on page 26, slides 41 and 42 show what the expected effect of the new tiers considered here might be on those contribution rates. So 41 shows the expected effect on the PERS system, 42 for the TERS system. On speaking first to slide 41, the solid line is similar to the base case line from the previous slide. It's the current program were no new tier to be implemented. And as described before, it shows increasing rates that gradually increase to a little bit over 30% and then begin to decline after the 25-year period. The dashed line shows what the effect of a new tier might be in the future. And what we have done is modeled the population into the future using our modeling tools, replacing members as they retire or leave the systems with members whose benefit levels are as described in alternative 1 or 2. And the dashed line shows the effect of that over time. And it does show that at the end of roughly a 25-year period, we would expect significant cost savings on the order of 6-7% to the PERS system of the new tier. However, it does show that, of course, it takes a considerable amount of time for the savings to develop relative to their current level. And the obvious reason for that is that the proposed alternative is in the form of a new tier. Currently, there's nobody in the system whose benefit levels would be under the new tier, and it would take a considerable length of time for current members to leave the system and be replaced with members under the newer tier. Slide 42 shows analogous information for the teachers system. The contribution levels, as you know, are higher for the TERS, so the scale year. But nevertheless, after 25 years, the savings level is similar. It's a 6 to 7% difference between the dashed line, the new tier line, relative to the solid line, the current program with no new tier. But similar to what we see for the PERS, it takes a considerable amount of time for new members to enter the system with those new benefit levels and for that savings level to be realized by the system. So the expected long-term savings would be in the area of 6 to 7%, but it would take quite some time, as you see from the charts, for that savings to enter the systems.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And that concludes the prepared material that I had. Just to round this thing out, the next three slides show detail as described earlier, 27 through 29, and then the remainder is detail on the employer survey portion of the information gathering.
Melanie, did you have more information to give today, or did that conclude your
presentation? That concludes our presentation, Madam Chair.
We have a few minutes. Do we have some questions? Do you need the people from revenue back at the table?
I don't know who would be the best. Let me address them to Melanie, and you can use whatever assets you need to use, if I might. Thank you. And I have three or four questions, if I might, Madam Chair.
Just a minute. I'm just going to ask revenue to go ahead and come to the table so we don't have to take the time, if you don't mind, please. And join Matt.
Melanie, I'd heard information that there's a window in the next 4 or 5 years of a lot of old-timers, I use that word cautiously, retiring, and so that if we were to do a new tier, it would be most effective if we did it. So it would take an effect, go into effect the next 4 or 5 years. If we wait longer than that, the impact is reduced. Is that accurate information?
Through the chair, I would like Bob Reynolds to respond to that question because I have not done the analysis and I do not know what that impact would be. So,
Mr. Reynolds, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Would you please take that one?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Although I will say, I'm not sure. I am sure I won't be able to give you a numerical answer to your question. It is a good question. When we initially started this project, we did project the population into the future of the two systems over the next 5 and 10 years, and so we did project the retirements that we expected to occur and where members would need to be replaced in the system, and that in each of the systems, that information is available, as I described earlier, on the division's website. The projections that we show on page 26 project the effect of a new tier were it to be implemented in the very near future, essentially today or in the next year or 2 years. We did not do a projection where we posed the question, how would this look if a new tier were to be implemented 5 or 6 years in the future? So I can't answer that question readily. Clearly, it does defer by 5 years any savings that a new tier might bring into the system. And as you suggest, if there is a bubble of people retiring over the next few years, there is some, you might call it, opportunity lost in terms of replacing current membership with new tier members.
Thank you. I'll defer to the co-chairs as to whether that chart would be useful in our further discussions or not, the cost of delay, if you will. If I might, Mr. Chair, a couple more questions. You mentioned your projected growth was 1% population growth. That is 1% of the people in the system, or how big a cohort was that?
Yeah, to respond to that, that's a 1% growth in the current active membership of the systems, and that was based on some recent historical analysis for the PERS system, we found that over the last 5 years, the active membership has grown 1.1%. For the teachers, it's somewhat less. The five-year growth was about 0.6% per year. So 1% appeared to be reasonable, but it's not our attempt to predict what we think will actually happen in the state of Alaska. We're not really able to do that.
Okay, thank you. Well, and we may want to see how these mesh with Department of Labor projections that our working population is going to diminish considerably in the next 10 years. And one final question, and that's probably in your ballpark, and that is just a question about the cost of money. I tread in actuarial waters cautiously, but I know if I pay off a 30-year mortgage early, I save a substantial amount of money. Has there been any projection as to what the state might save if they paid off this indebtedness early?
Yeah, again, to answer that one through the chair. The time value of money is factored into all these calculations. While it's true, and I'll use the example of a mortgage, if you pay a mortgage off early, you do save nominal dollars. If you could, on the other hand, invest that money at your mortgage rate, you could just as well not pay it off, ignoring taxes, pay it off over time, and the time value, under the time value money theory, all things would be equal. You'd have, in the long run, paid the same amount. That said, we have been asked by the division to analyze the effect of paying off portions of the unfunded early, and we're in the process of doing that work. A simplistic answer to your question would be to go back to slides 2 and 3 and to direct your attention to the right-hand column of figures, which shows that if you pay off the entire unfunded for each system, the cost rate would decrease from 25.63% for the PERS to 13.24%, and correspondingly from 38.85% for the TERS to 14.28%. And that would be the savings realized from paying off the entire unfunded. Portions of the unfunded would apply essentially pro rata to the past service rate. So if you paid off half of it, the past service rate would decrease by half.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Doug, I think we're going to have to close this out today so that we can get to the floor. And helping us to make a decision to see if we can meet tomorrow. Are each of you available tomorrow at 9 a.m.? Or if you're not, we can reschedule for next week. How about the members? Any members here? Okay, because we are on schedule, but how is your schedule?
Good.
It's okay. Sure. And Mr. Reynolds?
Yes.
And me? Did you say...
Oh, I'm sorry. Was the question whether I could be available?
Yes, tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Alaska Standard Time.
Yes, I could be available at that time.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, I think it's in the best interest of everything. If everyone can get their questions together, and if you have the commissioner or Melanie or the other members heads up and let them know what the question is, they can come in with the information, probably with some backup. Or otherwise, you can have your questions ready for in the morning, and we'll try to do it in as timely a manner as possible so that your day is not disrupted as well. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Okay, otherwise, we will reconvene tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Senate Finance is adjourned.